Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Wandering DMs live stream. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. And today we're going to be talking about death and critical hits and possibly resurrection, maybe. We'll see if we get to that, Paul.
Excellent. Yes. Certainly a hot issue when you're playing without clerics is, can the dead come back to life?
Yes. Yes. Can you avoid death at all? sometimes is the question.
Yeah.
So this is great, and it's a little experiment because Paul just sprung this topic on me in the last 5 minutes. So we'll see if I can be coherent without my standard half day of prep time. So interestingly, we have totally, this is one of the areas where Paul and I have totally different rules.
Yep.
On it.
Let's start where we agree. I think, right? Like,
okay.
I think we've both decided to agree on the idea that by the book, right? By the book, you get to 0 hit points, you are dead, end of your character. That we are not happy with that.
Yeah.
Okay. There
I'm
you go.
To that. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
And I'll say that historically, right? Historically, most editions, later editions, softened that. So.
Yep.
Whereas by the book in original D&D, 0 hit points, you're expired, you're dead, that's it. And then as of advanced, they started to say, like initially it was like, if you hit 0 directly on the number, then you start ticking down into negatives until a certain point. And then by third edition, it was you've got this buffer all the way down to negative 10 before you actually die. So it's certainly we're certainly not alone in wanting that to happen.
Yeah, I definitely find, I think that it's valuable to the players to have a real tangible change of state when they're, like, in the danger zone, I guess, of, like, not dead but probably going to die. And the problem is, with sort of 0 equals dead, is that where does that happen? That's maybe 6 to 10 hit points, right? Somewhere maybe 5 to 10 hit points, right? So, whenever I'm at that point where, like, the next hit could kill me, so it depends on how much damage my enemy's doing.
Right.
And that kind of soft numeric value, I think most players just don't see it. Like, it's just crunchy enough that, like, if I'm wandering around with, like, 5 hit points, it's not really entering my head that, like, oh, yes, the next hit could kill me.
Right. Right.
Maybe you disagree with that.
No, I don't. It's a thought that hadn't. I don't think it had occurred to me quite like that. I don't disagree with it.
So it's interesting. I think that's one of the nice things about the like ticking down in the bleeding category, right? Certainly, that gives you this buffer of time of, oh no, our friend is in trouble. We had better help them.
Right.
And it's just a much more tangible and obvious, right? Like, okay, you got knocked down to 0. Now these rules come into play. My problem with it is that. Great for your allies, but not so great for you personally, because you still can do nothing.
Right, right. And certainly, like, in like the times I've played Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, that was a little bit frustrating for exactly that reason.
So that's interesting that you bring up Warhammer, because my solution to this problem is inspired by Warhammer.
Right, I know.
So before I blur the line into that, I want to talk a little bit about crits. So traditionally, I think, first of all, by the book, there's no such thing, right? Critical hits, I think, just don't exist.
Basically, and then some snarky member of the nerdocracy will come in and say, except in the aerial combat rules.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah, there's in the original D&D... Volume 3, and we believe it was written mostly by Arneson, inspired by Mike Carr's battle in the fight in the skies, or Dawn Patrol. If you look at the aerial combat rules, there is a critical hits chart specific to aerial combat rules, where you either hit the flyer's head or rider or wing or tail.
Interesting.
Yeah, so some snarky person's going to say something like that. But in the basic melee man-to-man with a sword, there isn't anything like that.
So in that aerial combat rules, maybe now I'm pushing your knowledge, but in that aerial combat rules, what triggers such a hit?
Any hit, basically.
Any hit has a percent chance, or will always, or Dan is now scrambling to look up the rules and find out.
I am scrambling to look up the rules. Yeah, I think you basically have it. I think any hit has a particular percentage chance of. It's always weird that it comes before the ocean going rules. First, every single hit you roll for where on the body it hit. And then if you hit him in the head, it's 20% chance for a critical hit. And if it's in the wing, it's 20. And if it's in the body, it's 10%.
Interesting.
So there's at least three different rolls. So every single hit, you're supposed to roll for location, then probability of critical hit, then actual effect of that critical hit.
And now Dan, look up these more rules for me. What is the chance of being hit in the head, for example?
Depends on the firing position.
Okay. Never mind. Too complex.
So from the front, it's 2 in 10.
Okay.
From the tail, it's only 1 in 10.
Okay. So let's say worst case, 1 in 10, 10% chance, and then times a 20% chance of actually scoring a crit.
Right.
Is that the 2%? Am I doing that right?
I think so. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, about 2% chance of scoring a crit in that situation. Okay. The reason I was asking that is I kind of wanted to crunch the numbers because, of course, the thing that we more commonly see is folks rule, if you roll a natural 20, that's a crit.
Yeah.
Right. That's pretty common, and that's easy.
And usually double damage, right? So usually people say double damage or maybe max damage on a 20.
Yep. And that's about a 5% chance.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So that's interesting. So I typically don't do anything special on a 20 or a 1, right? Then you have the inverse, right, of a natural 1 is like, if it's not a critical, it's the opposite. It's a fumble, and you drop your sword or something bad happens.
Right.
Make it up. I have used those in the past, and in my experience, and this is actually coming from my players. This is not from me directly, but my players' analysis of this is that it happens to them much more than it happens to me, that they're rolling more dice, ergo, they are more often crit and more often fumble. Maybe it was the other way around, that they felt that they were always getting critted against. Anyway, eventually my players were like, we don't want to use this.
Yeah, and in fact, that analysis is pretty solid. And in fact, it's actually in the third edition book, actually. If you look in the third edition DM's guide, that what you just said is actually in a sidebar in the book, rationalizing why you might not want to use critical hits.
Interesting.
Actually.
Interesting.
So it's reasonable. And I mean, to make a long story short, like I do have critical hits and fumbles that are triggered by natural ones and 20s. I agree, if you did it every single 1 in 20, that would be excessive. Mm-hmm. So I give a saving throw to the victim to possibly avoid it. And there are some nights, I think it works pretty well. And then there are some nights where the players come away going, that whole night was all fumbles. That whole night was just a story of fumbles for everybody.
Interesting. So my complaint or my criticism of the saving throw would be that makes it sound like the chance of crits or fumbles happening goes down as we level up.
Yeah, and that's intentional.
Interesting.
Like, particularly the fumbles. Like, I certainly feel that higher level characters should be less likely to drop their sword than lower level. So on my part, that actually was intentional. And the fact that they can avoid criticals better is I think a feature, not a bug for me.
Right.
Yeah.
One
little side detail there is initially I had a problem with fighters with multiple attacks. You roll two attacks and now there's two chances for a one to come up with a fumble. And so I had to come in with the rule that says you can only possibly fumble on the first roll each round, so that when you get multiple attacks, you're not fumbling more often. But I want higher level characters to fumble less often.
So for me personally, first of all, I don't use fumbles at all, which is not to say comical things never happen, but they're entirely situational, right? If the player or the monster has decided to do something interesting, unusual, and I had to make a ruling on the fly of, okay, here's how that works, sometimes I will then roll in, and if you fail, maybe roll this save or whatever, and something comical happens. So they happen, but it's super rare. As far as crits go, so I rolled my crit system into my solution for making 0 hit points equals dead less painful. Specifically, my system is once you've been knocked below zero, we roll on the critical wound chart, which is kind of based on Warhammer's critical wounds, or inspired by, I should say, because it's actually pretty different from those charts. But essentially, you get some kind of terrible thing happen to you, which could be like a twisted ankle or a broken arm. It's actually like two different rolls. It's a severity and a location, so there is a very small chance you like get severed head and then yeah, it didn't save you. Turns out you're dead anyway. but generally, since that's so rare, everyone really enjoys it when it comes up.
It's
so rare that they go, "Oh, a decapitation! Holy cow! That's exciting!" And then they're okay with it. But usually, some kind of critical effect, and then I have rules for how to heal those critical effects. And also, then the follow-up rule is if you have any kinds of any serious injury like this, and you take any damage at all, you definitely die. And my goal there is to give players that little, that like one or two round buffer between, he just broke my arm. I'm really in danger now. Maybe I should get out of here.
Right.
Give them that chance to run away, maybe.
Right. So for me, so the way that we use critical hits is sort of inverse. So your critical hits are when you hit zero to give a little bit of an extra safety buffer.
Yep.
Whereas my critical hits can happen at any time. And to be clear, I do use an article in Dragon magazine. It's from July 1980 by an author named Carl Parlagreco. So this would be Dragon magazine number 39 with a table of like two pages of pretty detailed critical hits. And it's something that, Gygax argued against vociferously, said he hated the idea. So for me, the critical hits, which can get spawned off a 20 after a save, give an additional threat to combat, is at any particular time, there is a small chance you can get decapitated from any hit, no matter how many hit points you have, is potentially on the table. Mostly it's hit point damage being taken in combat. Once in a while, it provides an interesting detail that I wouldn't have personally thought of if I didn't have the pre-written table in front of me. And so you do have things like people breaking fingers and breaking swords and shields and double or triple damage. And if anybody did go to my blog, and so there, I guess you're looking at, I guess that's the one you use, or what were you looking at?
Sorry, I did that right where you could see it, Dan.
Do other people?
I was listening to you and trying to remember whose tables I stole, because I also didn't write my own tables.
Okay.
I wanted to make sure I give credit. Go on.
Gotcha. So if anybody went to, I excerpted the tables I use on my blog. So if someone did go to my blog, Delta's D&D Hotspot, and just search for critical hit tables, you would see the entirety of what I use. So for me, there are additional threat that can come in at any particular time. And I kind of like having that extra level of threat of potentially having something really horrible happen to you if you're in combat on either side. When they hit 0 hit points, I do just give a simple save versus death at that point.
Right.
And if you save, you're unconscious for a couple minutes. And if you fail, you are totally just dead at that point.
Interesting.
So the way that we use criticals differently is for you, it's that buffer at zero. And for me, it's an extra opportunity to get to zero.
Right. Now we are both, it sounds like we are both introducing this concept of these like really dangerous, bad injuries, right? Like, do you end up with limb loss or other weird stuff like that from your charts?
Well, Indra, I keep expecting that, and it actually hasn't happened yet, and I'm not entirely sure why that is, if it's just, like, really rare on the charts or not.
Interesting.
It doesn't feel like it is. It feels like there's, like, a 1 in 3 chance for something like that. There are entries of things like hit in the head, lose 2d6 intelligence points unless you have a helmet.
Interesting.
And so these times come up and I ask the player, and I read that out loud, and I ask the player, do you have a helmet? And they go, oh, thank God, yes, I do. Right? So there are things like that.
Yeah.
And then I've also...
Does anyone ever answer that question? No, of course not.
Not yet. I did have one person when we were playing at your house last summer who did get outright just slashed in the throat and died with nothing that could possibly prevent it right at the end. But actually, I don't have anybody with a limb loss right at the moment.
Interesting. So the charts I use come courtesy of, I'm going to look at this again, Dennis Tetrault, or Tetrault.
Yep.
I apologize for mangling your last name, Dennis. The what I like about these charts is, one, it's a very detailed location chart, right? So first of all, you've got not just leg, but you've got foot, shin, knee, thigh, you know, groin, gut, hip, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Even up to the, instead of just head, you have both head, face, and neck are all entries. And then I'm rolling a D8 now. Actually, originally it was a D6, but now a D8 for severity, with the severities scattered across those percent chances of either being broken, maimed, or severed. And then I, on the fly, have to interpret what does a severed knee mean, or what does a broken... whatever. So, like I said, originally I was using a D6 for that, and I found even on a D6 that a 1 in 6 chance of severed was too severe. And so I upped it to a D8 for a 1 in 8 chance of severed, because basically, by level 5 or so, every single character in my game was missing some piece of their anatomy. Every one of them. It was like a ridiculous Pirates of the Caribbean type thing, and it actually totally shaped my campaign for a while, because the major goal of the party at that point was figure out a way to magically restore lost limbs, which doesn't exist in any of the magic in the system at a base. So there you go. It was actually, I really enjoyed it, and it actually added quite a lot to my campaign as my players tried to find ways to restore lost limbs, and also then, you know, had various false appendages and whatnot, which was quite funny.
Right.
And I did have one player death that happened due to a severed face, which was super fun. That happened actually as a result of a fight all by himself with a bunch of pixies. And so I decided that they were truly evil pixies, and they then used his face to try and impersonate him. So that was again, these are sort of results I got out of these charts that I'm just so pleased with. I can never give up these charts.
That's golden. That is pure gold.
That was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. When the party finally stumbled on the pixies and they see their friend looking a little strange, that was great.
I will say, so I actually am kind of continually surprised that I don't have limb loss.
That is unusual.
To date. But I will say that, thinking of your stories from your campaign, I recently actually did place a ring of regeneration somewhere in my campaign.
Yep.
So my players, that could be anywhere in the world, but there is current, I do know the location of a ring of regeneration just because of your stories about that being important.
That's in fact how my players eventually solved it, was with a magic item that was the equivalent of a ring of regeneration.
Yep.
I decided ring was too giving, and so it was actually a very fragile twig leafy crown.
Of
regeneration.
Great.
So they had that, but then of course they had to constantly protect it, so of course they built crazy case for it and whatnot, and they were very protective of their, you know, delicate crown of regeneration.
This show is getting more holiday themed all the time, and I like it. That's great.
There you go.
That's great.
That was their special.
You know, on the issue of like how deadly is the game? One thing that I think I've philosophically come to recently is to kind of have a principle of giving a save for everything. Is like you almost cannot die in my game anymore until you roll a d20 for a saving throw that causes you to finally expire.
Interesting.
So I think I'm kind of committed to, like, you can't ever die with me just telling you that. It's always going to be a result of something you rolled.
But I guess I was about to ask, but what about poison, right? But I suppose that still is a saving throw that you roll. Now, do you find, has this reduced the number of deaths in your game, or is it still very deadly?
You know, we haven't had a death in a while. I got to say, actually, when we were at starting levels, I was like TPKing the campaign party like crazy. And honestly, we've gone a couple months without a death, actually.
Interesting. See, now I would posit that that's actually that the deadliness of the game is part and parcel of being old school in my head. And not just because it's traditional to be so, but because newer editions, I think, give so many options to play your characters that you're much more invested in your character and you spend more time building them, such that like having them taken away and having to rebuild it is quite onerous to the player.
Yeah.
Whereas in general, in my game, when someone dies, I hand them a blank character sheet and say, start rolling. And if they manage to finish by, well, the combat's still going, they show up while the combat's still going. They get in there very, very quickly. And I think my players enjoy this, right?
This is part of the fun
of the game. I even went so far as in my blog to keep a log of every player death, and it's something like 40 or 50 deep at this point with how the player died, and it's amusing. It's amusing to us. We enjoy it.
that is very old school, and it's very amusing. I mean, the other thing is I have really good players at the moment, and possibly too good in some ways.
So perhaps it is a challenge to you to find a way to more deviously kill them. More cloaks of poison, Dan. I suggest more cloaks of poison.
I did not write that. I did not write that, just to be clear. I was just reading. I just read that.
For our listeners, Dan did once kill me with a cloak of poison. No save. You're dead.
Which is written by Gygax. It's in the book, and it's in Module D2, and he picked it up, and he put it on. And I would play it differently now. Nowadays, yes, thinking about that largely, absolutely, everything would be good to save, no matter what Gary wrote it. I don't care how many times he writes no death, no save. There's a save.
That's funny. The funny thing is, I definitely remember being quite surprised at first. I was like, what? And then once it kind of washed over me, I went, wait a minute, this is wonderful. I can now say I've played a character who came across the Cloak of Poison in, what module is that? Is it one of the Ds, I think, right?
Yeah, it's D2, yeah. Shrine of KOTOA.
Came across the Cloak of Poison, put it on, and died.
Yeah.
And then I got to play a bunch of gnomes, I think, which was also super fun.
Yeah, so in a standard emergency protocol, the next encounter had gnomes, and I'm like, here, have a gnome now.
I'm pretty sure I had, like, three gnomes or something like ridiculous like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think there was a leader gnome and he had a couple minions,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. So then I really felt like I was living the Dan Collins experience at that point. Playing multiple characters. Dying.
So the principle is the same as what you just did. If someone dies in my game, they immediately start rolling up a character, and I've been very happy to discover that it's streamlined enough that even at first sight my new to D&D players could immediately start doing that on their own without any guidance from me while a combat's running. I've had new characters run in during a combat. Now, my rule in the books now actually is you do have to wait until the combat's over so that I don't have just like a nonstop stream of characters running into an infinite fight.
Yep.
I can still TPK you. The point of that is I can still TPK you. Still TPK. Right?
That's a good
if people
point.
Start going down, maybe everybody goes down. So that's on the table.
I would say generally that what I'm usually saying is I will bring you back in as soon as I can, and I don't really give any specific promises. But if it's fine for them to roll into the combat, I do. And if it's not, then it's not. But
I've done that.
The
other thing I would say is because I do have. My campaign actually is kind of revolving around a mega dungeon right at the moment, mostly. Okay. And so, you know, it's laid out with, you know, predefined locations, and the player characters can get to decide where to go. So as I think I'm not the first person to notice that they're kind of dialing in their own threat level a bit.
Yep.
So they go to a place, and if it's too hot, they take off, and then they plan their next incursion kind of carefully. So they're in a capacity where they're kind of able to dial it in, and I can't arbitrarily just spring arbitrary danger on them either.
That's great. I think that's great. That's what I really like, or one of the things I really like about old school gaming is how much really is in the player's control. Certainly I think Sorry, I've been doing a lot of story game versus modern traditional gaming versus old school gaming thought process and discussions with people recently. And I think it's one of the things actually that story games and old school games agree on is player driven. But I think a lot of folks don't realize that old school really is that player driven.
That's a great observation, and you interfacing with story style gamers to bring that out is really great, actually, because I forget that for some people isn't totally visible.
So here's an interesting thing, just to go back to old school gaming and death and the frequency of death. I think a lot of times old school games get a bad rep of being like, oh, you have this megalomaniacal GM who just kills players at a whim and he cackles with glee. Yeah, a little bit, yes. But, yes, okay, I'll cop to it, yes, a little bit.
Let the cackling commence.
But I would also say it's part of the fun. And I think the way it can be part of the fun is by making sure you set expectations early. And I do this in my convention games all the time, where I will, when I sit down to an OD&D convention game, I will hand out the stack of player characters, or the pre-generated character sheets. And usually there's well more than players at the table. Like if I'm seating 8 players, I might have 12 to 16 characters. And right. I'll say, yo, there's plenty to go around. Don't worry about like picking the last wizard or whatever. There's plenty to going around because it's very possible that we'll need a team B before this game is over.
Right. That's great. And I gotta get better at using that. That is a great idea that I actually just jotted down the specific number you quoted because I need to get, that's such a great idea. I need to get better at that. Usually if I expect to have 9 players, I bring 10 or 12 characters, and that is a great idea to bring a whole giant stack, you know, more than that.
In my head, I feel like an extra double what I need is really allowing for the TPK moment. It almost never happens, and more likely like an extra 50% is fine, well more than enough. But really the whole point is to set that expectation in the very beginning of the game. You're sitting down and I'm telling you, this game is deadly, your characters might die, and that's okay. We'll still have fun after that.
That's really beautiful. I need to use that better. What I've done in tournament games for WoW is I give out like 1 or 2 scrolls of reincarnation.
Yep.
And the impact is not the same. If that works, then at the end of the game you say nobody expired. And your method of like, no, there are actually people on the ground as a result of this action is really better. So I got to do that.
Oh, so you brought up reincarnation. Let's talk about
coming back from the dead. So obviously if I and you are playing in a game with no clerics and there's no cure light wounds and there's no cure disease and there's also no raised dead and there's also no resurrection, an easy solution for the healing is to give out cure light wounds potions. That's certainly very available in my game. Mm-hmm. But then the question is like, can you come back at all from death? And fortunately, the wizard, the magic user spell list, has always had a 6th level spell called reincarnation on the list. So at least there's something in the game that permits that. I heavily modify that spell quite a bit. Mm. So when, the way reincarnation is in the book is just random roll for what kind of thing you come back as.
Yeah. When I tell players about reincarnation, usually their reaction, if they know D&D at all, is, oh God, what am I coming back? I'm going to be like a pixie centaur.
Right. And it's funny because that totally crazy stuff comes from the druid list in AD&D. So in original D&D, it's a lot more basic. It's like you're either human or dwarf or elf or dwarf, if I didn't just say that. Randomized class, and then there's a very, very small chance for totally random arbitrary monster.
Yep, and that's true in the BX spell as well. That's when I was running BX. So when it was a concern for my group, I was running BX. I don't think I've yet to really run an OED campaign.
Yeah. Okay.
So this issue has not been come up for me in a campaign setting where I think it really matters, right? Mm-hmm. In a convention game, it kind of matters, but again, I kind of hand wave around that by just being like, there are more characters. Don't worry about it. They'll come in.
That's probably a better method.
In campaign play, when I was running BX, I still had Raised Dead. Now I did, because I'm using BX, I don't have spells above 5th level of power, I think. Is it fifth or sixth? One of those
and
two.
Six is there.
Okay, great. But that means that still, like, the only way you're coming back is a reincarnate or a raised dead from a cleric. And then I also amped up the difficulty of raised dead and insisted on the somatic component of a ridiculously expensive gem, which again became part of my campaign setting and an interesting factor where I had a lot of adventures based around like, oh crap, we need a gem right now. How do we get one?
Did you start that? So that's in the book for third edition. Was that an idea from third edition?
Yeah. So I totally stole it from third edition. I think I made it a factor of 10 even more expensive than what's in there. I think I asked for a 500 gold piece gem, and keep in mind that I'm using, as you do in OED, I'm using a silver standard. So really that's like a 5,000 gold piece gem in sort of more. It's a lot.
Great.
It's a lot.
Great.
And it does mean that like, when your first or second level character dies, the party probably isn't going to spend it on you.
Yeah. Yep. Very good. Very good. The comic strip Order of the Stick uses that same method. Mm-hmm. So anytime they have to bring somebody back, somebody has to get an expensive gem. They had a gag a couple weeks ago, I think, whereby that someone discovered an enormous cache of jewels, including a whole bunch of diamonds, and then repeatedly murdered someone they didn't like and then brought them back several times. right, is what they did. I think we had one of our friends was like playing in a adventurers league or something like that, and intentionally like bought a gem specifically like as insurance in case they need to get raised. And then all the other players thought they were insane because that wasn't permitted or something like that. So I've seen people, if I'm not correct, somebody we know like interfaced with another gaming group where they didn't expect that and were like thought that was a crazy move to do. Hmm. But it seems like a reasonable campaign thing for me.
Yeah, I totally think so. Certainly when I awarded them, the players hoarded them, and more often than not, they just didn't have any. And when someone died, then it spun the adventure in a totally new direction because they just scrambled to get one.
Gotcha. So
they would make shady deals with people they probably shouldn't be dealing with, and then find themselves in terrible binds to fulfill whatever obligations they had promised. It was actually a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
That's great. I mean, any mechanic that turns into more adventuring is a great mechanic as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I agree.
For me, with my custom Book of Spells edits, which probably has a little bit more editing on the high level of spells, I give, probably you've seen this before, I give a saving throw, actually, again. So if you're dead and someone casts reincarnation on you, you get a saving throw. If you make it, you come back just like you were before. And if you fail it, then you go to the randomized what kind of thing are you table.
Nice.
My
note of complaint of oh, but it gets easier as you go up in level, actually in this case I like that.
Okay.
It's easier for a higher level character to come back to life because again those are the ones you're going to bother to try on.
Yeah.
Whereas a first or second level character a little more throwaway.
Okay, interesting. That's good to hear. Yeah, I had it, the one weird thing, so for me in my campaign, you have to go find somebody that has that spell. So obviously the characters are nowhere near that level.
Yep.
So I have to go find somebody with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have a penalty to the save of -1 per day.
Nice.
So you're under a time crunch about can you find somebody in time?
Yeah, That existed for me in my campaign as well, just because that is the nature of the Raise Dead spell, is that it is time limited.
Yeah, yeah.
Based on the level of the caster, I think. So I guess it's nice that I like the idea of equating it to the level of the person who died, or the save, right? Or the no, it's neither of those. It's the number of days they've just been dead for. Still good. Still like.
Right. Yeah. So traditionally, there's like a hard right. So traditionally in D&D, there's a hard limit based on the level of the caster. Yeah. And I kind of like having a, it's pretty simple. It's -1 per day and the clock is ticking. If you're high enough level, potentially you could come back after a little while. The weirdest thing that's happened to date is last year I was playing the first of the Slavers modules, in a convention, mm-hmm. and like as usual, I gave out a scroll of reincarnation. So somebody died.
Yep.
They used the reincarnation on it. They failed the save. We go to the arbitrary monster table, and they came back as a Hydra. And the players did not think that was a possibility. So they were like, what? And like all of a sudden they had a giant Hydra in the room with them that they had to run away from.
Oh, so at that point the player's a monster. They're not like, I'm just in a Hydra body. It's cool.
Correct. I have, so my little footnote is what do I say here? If this is a PC type, then get a class and level. Otherwise, it's a normal monster run by the DM. So I feel like if the DM wants that kind of thing to be a character in their campaign, run with it.
Right.
But
right.
Hydras have a lot of problems.
Yeah.
So I said no on that one.
Yeah.
But if it had been like a bugbear or an orc, then maybe I would have said yes.
Right. Little difficult for a Hydra to climb a rope.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. So
even harder than for other characters in my campaign.
That was always my argument against people when they wanted to do weird player classes like centaurs. Yeah, centaurs, yes. Sounds cool until ropes and ladders come out, and then it sucks.
I totally agree. I feel like that, or just staying in an inn or something like that.
Right.
So for me the line is like, are you humanoid? Is basically where I might be willing to play with it.
So I think if I were going to run an OED campaign tomorrow, I would stick with the reincarnate thing, just basically as you have it written. But I think I would also incorporate my physical cost, unless you already have that. Do you have a cost?
I don't. No, I dumped that.
Okay.
Obviously, it's in third edition. It was in the open gaming SRD to begin with, and I cut it at some point.
It was in the reincarnate spell? Specifically, or?
Oh. I don't know. Actually, now I don't know. I just looked that up.
Yeah. I liked what it... Honestly, I would bring it back, I think, mostly because I liked what it did to my world. I liked the effect it had on just the world-building aspect of it. But also, I don't know. I think it's it makes it feel even more valuable and rare when not only do I need to go find a freaking 11th level wizard, also, I gotta spend a lot of money.
How would you deal? That's great. How would you deal with player complaints if they did that quest, got the money, spent it, and then failed the save?
My initial reaction is tough shit.
Now that's old school.
You knew the risks. I mean, you knew that there was going to be a roll at the end of this, right? You knew it wasn't a given.
Yeah. They bought their tickets. They knew what they were getting into when they got on the plane.
Right. Now there's one downside to it. One major downside in general to that stuff, which is if it's in the moment, in the heat of the moment, the one thing I don't want to do is sideline one player. Right, I don't want this player who just died to be like, great, now I have to sit idle for the next two sessions while these play, while all my friends go and try and find a wizard and blah blah blah. So in general, I'm pretty giving on that end, to the point of like, if it's going to spawn an adventure, ooh, we got to go get a gem. No, I'll give them the gem right away. You got to promise me a lot of stuff, right? There might be a Gaius involved. There might be a you know, whatever. The people might be coming to break your legs if you don't pay them back tomorrow, kind of thing. So I put the pinch on, but I give them the benefit first.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, another option would be like have them roll up a temporary new character,
mm-hmm.
right? And then maybe become a henchman later on or something like that.
Ah, henchman. Okay, this that might drift into a totally different topic, but actually, one of my favorite techniques that I use in my games all the time is to encourage the party to have at least one sort of favorite henchman around. Who does get a share of XP and does level up slower than the rest of the party, with the knowledge of this could be somebody's next character. Like, this is an option. If somebody dies and you don't want to get the resurrection, this could become your new character. Also, I use them as a loner of like, oh, our old buddy from college is in town for just 1 week and wants to sit in a game. Great.
Yeah.
Play that henchman.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, we have that has to be a separate show for us. But
I could talk about henchmen forever. Yep.
I've actually given up. Like my current players, like I can't get them to. They had one henchman, and they're not interested in getting any more. And I actually have sort of given up, actually, on even suggesting it because they are just not interested in having henchmen.
That is bizarre. What do they perceive as the downside of a henchman?
It's legitimate. It's chopping up the treasure more. It's chopping up the XP more.
Yep.
And I do think that these current players are coming to the table expecting they're going to get to role play one person.
Yeah, that's interesting. That is okay. The latter part is very interesting. And again, we should totally spin this off into a separate conversation.
Right.
But I'll just say that my group, and this has just got to be group by group differences, because my group loved the XP sync. They were like, "This is how we bank XP. We bank XP by putting it in the henchmen."
Really?
That is XP the GM can't take away from me by killing my character because it's in the henchmen.
Wow. What an interesting take on that. I never would have guessed that. Wow.
Yeah, they dug it.
Oh, my current players are like close to allergic to any and not getting the XP in their main player characters. That's really interesting. Huh.
All right.
Anyway, that's another preview to another show.
Yeah. Okay, the Henchman show coming soon. Yeah. Any more thoughts on death, criticals, or bringing back the dead?
I agree with you that, you know, for old school gaming, death should be ever present. Mm-hmm. It's always nearby. You know, coming back shouldn't be easy. So having some kind of limit on it is great, and having a limit that spawns more adventures is the best thing ever.
Yeah. I think, I actually want to think you gave me this quote. I can't even remember who said this quote, but there was somebody, some famous game designer perhaps, who said something along the lines of, like, the deadliness of the game should be inversely proportional to the time it takes to create a new character. I'm totally paraphrasing there, but...
I don't know where that's from. I don't know where that's from, but it's. I agree. I totally agree.
Research that one. I don't know. I feel like some. I feel like it was more said in the video game realm than the tabletop realm, but that doesn't make any sense.
The first time I ever heard that, it was for a tabletop.
Okay. It'd be interesting. I'm sure I'm mangling the quote
that.
Too. So you said that. It's a damn.
I might have. You know, sometimes I say these things and people come back later and go, "That was a great thing." I go, "I said that. I don't remember it, but boy, that was great." I agree.
Yeah. But I do think there's a lovely saying, right? Of sort of like, yes, you should be able to quickly make a new character and drop them in place because death is, you know, life is cheap, death is frequent, but we can still have fun after it happens.
You know, it's interesting because I was on Stack Exchange role playing games within the last week, and there was someone posting a question saying, "I am a 25-year-old person. I just moved into a house with a couple of friends. They have a regular D&D game. I would like to participate." I asked, and they said, "No, we cannot write you into an ongoing campaign. It's too much work." And this person was asking, like, "Is that correct? Is that a standard D&D rule?" And I got on there and I went, well, the old school response would be, of course not. That's flippin' ridiculous. Anybody should be able to drop in at any time, even halfway through a session, and we'll make a seat for you and you should participate, and I would love to have you at my table at any time.
That response feels very Gygaxian to me, right? Like, I certainly from reading his writings, it feels like he didn't know on any given night who the hell was going to show up.
Yeah, exactly. I quoted that. I absolutely quoted that exact thing, as a matter of fact. And so the you know, having things that are so burdensome to make a new character that someone can't participate in the hobby, it seems like a real failing in my view.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely it speaks to a different style of gaming. I think I can imagine the kind of game that they're running, where they're so deep into the character relationships and character backgrounds and blah 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 blah. Which again, I don't mean to poo-poo that. I do believe that old school games.
A little bit.
What's that?
I'll poo it a little bit.
You can poo it. Okay, that's fine.
I'll poo it a bit.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
You're welcome. That's fine. It's not a style for you. I think that like modern story games, when you look at games like The Fall of Magic, Fiasco, World of Dungeons, that kind of stuff, like the thing is there. both that style of gaming and old school gaming, I think both really love the concept of emergent story. But the story, the topic of the story is wildly different. In that style of gaming, the topic of the story is the characters and their relationships. Yeah. To the point, to the end where maybe almost the setting is almost irrelevant. Whereas I think in old school gaming, the story is the story of the world. The story is the story of the setting, and the characters are transitory.
Right. Right. I think that's a great observation. I think that's a great analysis that you've come up with on that, and it feels right to me.
There you go. And I like both. I like both. I will say that. I'll play either one. But I again will fall back on set my expectation up front. Tell me what I'm playing up front, and I'll have a good time.
Excellent. Yep. Agreed. And I've played in a game, you know, one of our friends ran a game of Dungeon World that I participated in, and you know, I had fun with that and considered running it myself at some point. but I do, you know, admittedly, I do like a D&D expectation where the DM has crafted some kind of location world that is objective and exists before we come to it that we're actually really exploring and finding out about.
I'm going to add that to our topic list. Can you improvise a dungeon crawl? Yeah. Okay.
Okay, yeah. Good.
Awesome. On the topic list.
How many cliffhangers can we work into one show? Here's another topic. How many cliffhangers can we create in one show?
Awesome. Let me try and close this out here. Any final thoughts on death, criticals, or resurrection?
I think that's it. I mean, so we have pretty different uses of criticals and pretty different ways of running the zero hit point moment. And, you know, both of our games are very good, and I like playing in yours. And I like, you know, people, I think, have a fairly good time in mine most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, likewise for me. I have no problems with the way you run it, and it's the way you run it, and I enjoy it. But I run mine my way, and you run yours your way, and sometimes you feel like a nut, and sometimes you don't.
Yeah, and original, you know, and I'll say original D&D even says that's okay. There's a point where it says what happens at low or zero hit points is up to the DM. If the DM wants to have broken bones, you can do that. That actually is in the book, and we take that and run in our personal directions with it. And that's what original D&D ought to be about.
Yep, agreed. Awesome. Yep. Well, if you have any thoughts, dear listener, about death, dying, critical wounds, or the return to the living of the dead, post in our comments section. Let us know what you think, and maybe that'll spawn yet another item for our topic list.
Yep. And at some point coming up soon, there'll be a discussion about henchmen and things like that.
Yeah. Henchmen, I think, is definitely up there on the list.
That's good. And as always, please, if you haven't done so yet, please subscribe to our Wandering DMs channel on YouTube. We are now over 100 subscribers.
Woohoo!
And if you need to remember, there's now a custom URL. You go to youtube.com/u/WanderingDMs. That's us. So thank you, existing subscribers that could put us over that. We are live every other Sunday at 1 p.m. So we'll have another live cast in 2 Sundays. In one Sunday, I'll have another of my Dan in Peru videos. There's 2 more to go.
Excellent.
So look for that next week. And then in 2 weeks, we'll be back for another thought-provoking discussion. And we'll talk to you then.
See you then.